So, Luke, why don't you tell us how Aucassin got its start and how Aucassin got its name? Because that's a unique name, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a funny one, huh? We get asked that a lot. It's Japanese for mother, is the simple explanation. But it's also, it's my family's last name. So my family are Irish. So I'm half Irish, and I took my grandmother's second name, and they were part of a clan called the Aucassins. So.
Nice. Now, how did you guys meet up?
We met up about, it's going back a long time now. It was about 10 years ago, and we met in Bath, which I don't know if you've ever been, but is a beautiful city. I've got to go back there soon. We hooked up there. It was the singer and I got together, and we spoke about bands that we adored. And then the bass player at the time, he was running the studio that we were rehearsing in. The rest was history.
Now how did the video for Camden Casualty come about, and how were you able? It was premiered on another online magazine, Kerrang, who hasn't heard of that. How were you able to get the premiere, and then how was the video shot and conceived?
So we've got quite a good rapport going with Kerrang at the moment, which is really nice. They've helped us out a lot. Alex Baker is one of the DJs over here, and he seems to be spinning us quite a lot. So super, super stoked about that. Really happy. And they did an exclusive on it last week. We did a bit of a weird out there video for it, which was inspired a bit boringly by a Google image search. I checked out online. I was checking out these really weird, and search for it. Do it yourself. Go onto Google and look up weird vintage photography, and man, some crazy stuff comes up. And one of the images was this woman. I think she's holding like a glass of gin. And she's dressed as this enormous eyeball. I was like, wow, what a cool piece of photography. So played around with it in Photoshop, because I'm a graphic designer. That's part of what I do, aside from the band. So I do all our artwork. And I was coming up with the front cover and was just like, why don't we base an entire video on this eyeball idea? So we kind of got help from all of our friends and the rest of the band. And we created these massive paper mache, it was like going back to school, paper mache eyeballs, and turned up in Camden and just shot whatever the hell happened at the time. We just went for it. We had a bit of a storyboard going, but generally just caught people's reactions. So you got to check it out. It's online now.
Oh yeah, I've seen it. I was wondering about the eyeballs actually, and because I mean it gives the video kind of a new level or maybe even a new perspective in a way. Like the first thing I thought was that you guys see everything, kind of like that metaphor.
I like that. Okay. So you took your own, something else away from it. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean from what I've got of the lyrics and everything else, that's kind of what it appears.
But isn't that the beautiful thing about music? Everyone interprets it in their own way.
Mm-hmm. But I really, really like the song actually too. So we started spinning it on our radio station Jammer Stream 1 last week too, and I really like the way the song is constructed and everything else. It kind of gives me that. That groove vibe that the post grunge movement has, but a modern take on it. So
that's cool.
Yeah,
that's good to hear, because we've kind of stripped back a lot recently, and we're going back to sort of more grungy, Nirvana roots. You see so many bands coming out these days, like Dinosaur Pileup and Drenge. I don't know if you've heard of them, but as you say, they're going right back to those sort of Seattle grunge roots, which we love, and we're kind of hopping back on the bandwagon.
Yeah, well, music, I always thought music has that kind of 20-year 20-year rule. Yeah, yeah, because if you remember, like, 10 years ago, 80s music started making a comeback. You know, mm-hmm. and now we're back, you know, now we're back to the Seattle movement, which I think is funny because that's when I graduated high school. So it's kind of like a nostalgia trip for me now too. But, what I really like what bands like Okasan are doing is it's a modern take on it. You can't really say that it's got both feet in that era. Like I would actually say it has a toe in that era and it's looking forward to the future.
that's a nice thing to say. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's a part of almost our problem. I mean, it's kind of a cool problem to have because it means we're completely diverse when it comes to, you know, what style of music we're doing. But when it comes to people marketing you and you know, label signing and stuff, you know, we've jumped from manager to manager and label to label. And it's been an amazing ride and we've done some awesome stuff, but it's so hard to market. Because, you know, there's elements of reggae in some of our music. You know, we've been dubbed with like the Heavy Police of kind of 2015, which is really cool. But there's so many other influences as well. So it doesn't kind of sit in any pocket.
Now, do you think that labels if you notice, there are a lot more indie labels now out there than there were 20 years ago. But do you think that labels in general are opening up to bands that are as diverse as Okasan that you know, will have songs that sound almost like they're from different bands? Or do you think they want, or do you think they still want actually that consistent sound that they had, you know, that they would look for in the 90s, like where if they heard one song, they think they've heard all of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're kind of stuck in this unfortunate situation whereby, as with most successful labels, they'll take a band that sounds very much like someone else that's doing really well at the moment, and they want it all wrapped up in a little box with a little bow tie, a little bow on the top. So it's prepackaged, ready and done to go out there, and they know it's going to sell well. They know the fans are going to turn up to the shows. They know they're going to sell records. But I think, as you say, because more and more labels are opening up, hopefully that's going to, you know, bring about this new opportunity for more diverse music, but we'll have to wait and see.
Now, do you think that kind of forces bands to into this thinking mode where, okay, everybody liked this song that we did, so now we've got to repeat that over and over and over again?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, it depends how precious you find it and what, you know, what you count as success with it, which is it's a different conversation altogether. But yeah, I know we're certainly guilty of it. Years and years ago, we were like, we have to write a commercial record. If you go back to our first album, Ricochet, which I'm still so proud of, you know, even to this day, it is an album of mainly singles, you know, because we basically wanted a pedestal. We wanted to sign up to a large label, get out there, get the fans we needed. And then after that, we knew that we could write whatever the hell we want.
Yeah, and I heard, you know, I heard some of that in your earlier music, and well, that actually leads me to the question too: how hard is that to write a single? Because, like, being a musician myself, like, I want to write a, you know, when I get a melody in my head or a riff in my head, I want to go for it, and you know, sometimes it's hard to say, okay, that would get played on the radio. It's hard to say that, but you know, from the perspective of the writer. So, how do you discipline yourself into a way of thinking like, to where, you know, okay, every song in this album is radio friendly?
Yeah, well, none of us, there are no strict rules. There is no absolute guaranteed formula for a hit song. Otherwise, you know, we'd all be rich and famous, or none of us would be. But there are certainly certain rules and guidelines that you can stick by. You know, an element of repetitiveness, you know, simple melodies, hooks. You know, you've got to ram that song with hooks, so the second the song's finished, people are walking away singing it. You know, the second people leave your show, they're still humming it when they go to bed. But I'm constantly surprised, you know, every single time I hear something on the radio that's completely out there, I'm like, how the hell did this get here? I can't figure it out. So as I say, there's no set rules.
Now, when you go into the studio, Do the songs change much, you know, as you're recording them versus when you when you've written them based on what we just talked about?
Sorry, I lost you there for a second, mate. Say
one last time. Oh, no, what I was saying was the music, you know, when you go in to record the music, does the music evolve during the recording session, you know, versus when you wrote the song based on what we were talking about before about how trying to make it radio friendly?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So we're quite strict with our songwriting process, whereby we rehearse loads. We write generally on laptops and using simple MIDI drums. Then we'll take it. We'll try and tour it first, because obviously, you know, songs develop naturally on stage as well. You know, you get a vibe for what the audience want. Then we take it to a studio to demo, and then from there we take those demos to another producer and re-record them. So it's a really grueling long process, but normally that means, you know, the song is in our eyes fully developed. There is something to be said for leaving it too long, where a song loses its vibe. You know, when you first get, you'll know this, you know, you get in the rehearsal studio, you play together, and there is just a vibe there and then. And if you're able to capture that, then there's some serious magic going down. But I think it's perhaps getting a balance.
Yeah, because also there also comes a point where, okay, you've written the song and you've hashed it out, and it's changed and changed and changed and modified to the point where you're bored with it.
Yeah. And I hate to use the word prolific because it makes you sound up your ass, but we write a lot. So by the time, you know, the singles come out, for example, Camden Casualty, you know, I love performing it live, but I'm done with it now. I want to move on to the next thing, which we are, you know, this week we're going into the studio to record a Christmas single, which we've always wanted to do. Yeah, it should be really, really good fun.
Now, how hard is it to record a Christmas single? Because when I think Christmas single, how hard is it to write one? Because when I think Christmas single, I think Bing Crosby.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But how about? I mean, you know, you must have seen some NAF music TV, and you catch all like the darkness and modern rock stuff. I don't know. Well, we wrote this track a while ago, and we went out to Italy and recorded it. We did like a live studio performance, which was really good fun, and it was all in 6/8, and there's little hints of the Christmas lyrics, you know, there's stuff about eating yellow snow. that is just screaming to go down this Christmas. We've always wanted to do it. We've, you know, never brought ourselves or never found the time, and by the time Christmas comes around, it's like, oh crap, it's too late. So we're trying to get it in now.
Yeah, and I always think too, like, you know, how do you like approach a Christmas single, because there's all sorts of religions and everything else out there too.
I haven't considered that.
Well, I mean, I noticed like, well, like the darkness you said, and Run DMC, they did one, and you know, I've heard tons of bands do them, but
we should try writing one for Allah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but like I always see most of the rock bands take the safe approach where they keep it to Santa and presents, you know, and like being with family and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it would have been good fun, and I'm so up for the cheesiness, and you know, we're totally going to get the jingle bells on there. I'm going to get a choir of kids and do all the typical stuff, but kind of steer clear as best I can from lyrics about Santa Claus coming down the chimney, all that kind of stuff, and just leave it a bit more open. You know, like is it The Pogues?
Yes.
That classic Christmas song, absolutely amazing. Barely one reference. I think maybe there's one about, you know, the time of year or something.
Family.
Yeah. And this one's strictly themed on enjoy life, don't be a dick, which is a wonderful message, I think.
Exactly. That's what it should be called. Merry Christmas, don't be a dick. There you go.
I'll consider it.
you gotta let us check it out when you release it and stuff, man. We'll check it out.
Of course, we'll send it over.
So, and now you were talking about you've got a tour coming up in Russia. How is that going to go?
So it's not going to be too long. I think we've got 3 or 4 dates. I think a couple in Moscow and some in St. Petersburg, which is exciting. I've never been to St. Petersburg before, and it's supposed to be quite beautiful. And that's coming about, I think it's halfway through November we're going to set off. And it's so much fun over there. And every time you get to a club there, it's absolutely rammed. There's just something about playing music outside of England where people are so, so appreciative, you know, of live bands. And that comes across you, like the second you walk into a club, you see everyone going for it. So it's, excited about it.
Now, do you see that the audiences in different countries react differently? Because I've heard from other bands that have said like, oh, when, you know, when we play this country, you know, they don't clap as much, but that's because they're getting into the music. I mean, do you have any analysis like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will limit it to pretty much the difference between England and the rest of the world. I mean, we went out to Canada once, and they're perhaps a little more like us, is slightly more reserved. You know, we've got a thing in England whereby we go to shows and we're just like, right, and we fold our arms and we're like, impress us, show us what you got. Whereas everywhere else, they just go absolutely ballistic. And I'm not sure exactly what that's down to, but I think we could definitely take the leaf out of their books. Having said that, is it Japan or China? I've heard they're quite strict with the way they you know, watch music, and you know, they sit down and they watch the shows, and when the song's finished, they get up and clap, and then they only clap for 5 seconds, and then they sit back down again.
Mm-hmm. That would be Japan, from what I understand, because I've interviewed bands that have gone to Japan before, and they all say something similar to that. And they'll also say, well, if you tell them to jump up and down, they'll do it, and you know, but it's kind of like, you know, as soon as you change a song, they'll stop.
That's crazy. I need to get out there. I need to get out there, get on stage and be like, buy all our merch.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, like I said, I had one band that said that when they went out to Japan, they thought they did horribly the first show because everybody was just like watching. It was like being in a movie theater. You know, nice. but then, you know, it was like they clapped, and then, you know, after each song, but then they were told later, no, that's a good thing. That means they liked you because they wanted it to be quiet so they could hear you. It's like they get
that's
into
absolutely
it.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'd probably think the same thing, you know, going out there if you didn't have any intel on it. Like, well, man, they weren't into it, you know, until you were told later.
Mm. Yeah. I've got to go. I've got to see it. I want to see it firsthand.
Exactly. Now, where's the most exotic place Aucassin's played?
I don't know. That's a good question. We've been to Italy a few times, and I've been to Russia before, done some stuff in Europe, and as I said, Canada. We've never been to the States, which I'd like to do. We've been asked over to do Australia, but that's never come about. I think Japan would definitely be one for the books. But no, I don't know. I suppose Russia would be it.
Wow. See, I think you would go good over here in the States. I think you'd make a lot of impact playing like Rocklahoma Festival, things like that.
Oh, thanks very much.
So because you guys would fit right in because you're original enough, but you would be roughly in the same vibe as most of the other bands.
Right. You okay. Know? Cool.
So
you'll have to hook us up.
Definitely. I'll send your video out. You know, see what happens. So, so we've got the tour in Russia. What do you have coming up with that? I mean, are you gonna? You're talking about going into the studio for your Christmas single. Are you gonna come out with a new EP? You know, next year.
So generally for the future, I think we're going to do, we'll do Russia, and then we're going to go off and hopefully do a few more dates around the UK, take a break for Christmas. And then next year, I think we'll start an entirely new plan. We'll plan a new tour for beginning of the year. We're weighing up as to whether we want to do a new album or carry on with the EP idea, because the EP thing is great. It keeps people really interested, and it means you can constantly release stuff. but I'm sure you'll agree with me, there's something really wonderful about an album and, you know, one bulk piece of work, you know.
I'm actually more of a fan of the album. I honestly don't, you know, between you and I and everybody listening, I honestly don't understand, you know, the EP logic. You know, even though, I mean, I know we're living in a digital age, but to me, it just seems like more music. But then I'm also the type that loves LPs still.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just consumer fashion, isn't it? And people's attention spans. I'm guilty for it as well. You know, if someone brings out a new single or something, I'll go ahead and I'll buy it. But I think albums go under the radar. And if they don't go under the radar, then you pick only like maybe two or three songs from that album and the rest of it disappears, you know, unless you're a huge fan of the band, of course. But yeah, no, I'm right behind you. And the vinyl thing has taken off so much recently. I don't know what it's like where you guys are, but over here, because I feel you, I live in a music venue, or I live above one. So we see bands coming in and out every day, pretty much. And they all turn up, and every single one of them has LPs on the merch table, which blows my mind. I can't believe it. And they sell those as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I see it all the time. You know what else I see too? I don't know if this is the way over in the UK or not, but we're like a precipice with the music industry over here in the States. You're starting to see the chain stores, you know, like National Record Mart, Virgin, stuff like that, actually get out of the music business as far as brick and mortar, but you're seeing all these mom and pop stores thrive.
You're gonna have to fill me into a mom and pop store.
Oh, mom and pop store is like a local place that just is in your city. Like the owner lives, you know, the owner works there and everything. And
all right, okay, that's a new one. I can go in the song. I'll write that one down. I like that.
But
sorry, completely aside your point. What we were saying, but they're doing well selling EP LPs. Sorry, but the major stores are.
Oh, the record, I mean, but the local record stores, you know, the mom and pop stores, they're thriving, but all the chain stores, like all the national coast to coast stores, are going out of business.
Yeah, I suppose there's something quite nice about that, right?
Oh yeah, it's kind of prophetic, actually, you know, because they're the ones that tried to put the mom and pop stores out of business. And the only national chains we have left over here that actually sell any music are like Walmart, Target, Best Buy, places like that, that actually make their money selling computers and clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really good to hear and to see. And I never thought I would, you know, years and years back, especially when we went through, like, you know, the 90s, early 2000s, you had all the boy bands and constant, you know, some really bad R&B numbers. And I remember discussing with friends, like, it's never going to come back around again. We're never going to see, you know, forgive me, proper music, people playing together. And it has. It's kicked off more than I ever expected it to. So this is good news. I'm gonna jinx it.
Yeah. The last. Yeah, I think it's official. The last decade sucked for music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, but do you think every once in a while the music industry goes through that where it's like, okay, that, you know, it's got to be so bad to where people just kickstart it back where it's good. Like the late 80s, I think were like that, where you had, you know, the drum machines, you know, and the cheesy keyboards and so on and so forth. And then every hair metal band sounded alike.
Yeah, I mean, let's just pray that there's not some new technological revolution when it comes to music and everything, you know, revolves around that. Because I suppose that's what it was. It was self-discovery, wasn't it? It was people experimenting with all these new gadgets that were coming about. And we just had to sift through a load of shit and then came back to what was good again.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So I think everything's cyclic, you know. Well, but here's the thing, you know, you're talking about, your band and, you know, some of the other bands that are, you know, in your genre, you know, like kind of harking back to the grunge era, but taking it to a new level and stuff. And you know, we're in the middle of a decade, and usually it's the early middle part of the decade that where things really kick off.
Yeah, absolutely. And but sitting here and talking about this, I must hasten to add, not all music was crap. I don't want people out there sitting there listening to this being like, oh, what a dick. Because we did have some, you know, some great music during the 80s and 90s, just very, very little.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't what was at the forefront. You know, well, it wasn't. Yeah, I mean, like, it was what, you know, I think what makes a bad patch in the music industry is when all the crap gets pushed up front. Mm-hmm. You know, like the boy bands, like Britney Spears and all that other stuff that happened, you know, the last time around. It just, it ended up being where they followed each other to the point where they sounded like each other.
Yeah, and you know, there's still a market for it, but just sit and watch X Factor if you're into that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me ask you this: would Okasan do something like the X Factor or The Voice if asked?
No.
It's not. Tons of free exposure.
I don't care. I don't care. There's something that's really changed in us over, you know, 10 years of playing together. And had you asked us back then, you know, maybe it's something we would have considered. But we write for fun now, and we write what we love. And it's not about, you know, reaching that pedestal anymore. You know, I'm not saying that if it happens, I'd resent it in any way. It would be great. And, you know, that it would help us focus on the things that we'd love the most, which is, you know, traveling the world, meeting new people. But when it comes to money and being seen on every single billboard and, you know, every magazine, I just don't care anymore. It doesn't matter. It's all about the music and having fun.